Service Finance Policy Committee will come to order. The committee legislative assistant will note the roll. Is there a quorum?
Now, the House Health and Human Service Finance Committee will and Policy Committee will come to order. The committee legislative assistant will note the roll. Is there a quorum? There is a quorum. So as we begin today, Representative Gander will move the minutes from February 11th, 2024. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved for February 11th, 2024. Today, we are going to begin with a presentation from the Association of Minnesota Counties. So if they could start making their way forward. Welcome to the committee. As you're getting settled in, if you could please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Angela Youngerberg. I am the Director of Business Operations for Blue Earth County Human Services. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, known as MACSA, and the Minnesota Inter-County Association, known as MICA. Just want to thank you all for the opportunity to be here this morning and to talk with you a bit about how counties work with the state to deliver human services across the state. As you know, Minnesota operates a state-supervised, county-administered human services system. And what that in general means is that the state sets the policy and the county carries out the local service delivery delivered to individuals and families at the county level. In that state-supervised, county-administered system or model, the goal is to not have 87 different types of human service models or 87 different versions of what human services looks like to people that we serve, who are often Minnesota's most vulnerable population. But the goal is to have one mostly uniform set of programs so that people can move from one community to another, and when they do, they don't receive vastly different services. Consistency in policy, equity in funding, and a shared understanding of what services look and feel like for people are essential when we deliver human services. In human services, as you know, we deliver many, many different types of programs, each with unique and complex sets of rules, regulations, and goals. And so I'm going to focus on this relationship that we have in the context of four specific elements of Governor Walz's budget proposal. I will state, before I go into those four areas, that we're grateful for some of the proposals that were outlined in the governor's budget, specifically transitioning the adult mental health grants to a direct payment model. That will improve how we serve people dramatically. Providing assistance in providing access to a federal data source for our eligibility programs. That is an administrative win for all of us. And a concerted investment in fraud, waste, and abuse, which counties have a strong desire to be a partner in this important work. As you know, we are involved in fraud prevention, investigation, and fraud control services, and this is an area of particular interest to counties, and we look forward to future conversations. Most of the areas I'm here for today, if passed, would result in increases in local property taxes. While other testifiers will go into more detail on this, I'd like to point out that the counties that have the highest levels of poverty. We tend to talk about poverty in the context of human services. And those that have the highest levels of poverty often have the lowest ability to generate revenue through property taxes. So there's an inconsistency here. Shifting costs related to our most vulnerable Minnesotans onto property taxes will create inequities in access to services. When we talked about we don't want 87 different models, this will likely generate that type of result. And this is the very thing that we work so hard to prevent. So the first few areas that I wish to discuss with you are in the areas of behavioral health. For the Behavioral Health Fund, the state has a Behavioral Health Fund that was created initially as a way to fund substance use disorder services. The model is somewhat complex, but I will try to break it down into what it looks like for an individual and for the county. An individual would apply through a county for eligibility for substance use disorder services. And this is historical. So an individual would apply through a county for eligibility for the services. A county would then assess the individual and determine the appropriate services and placements as necessary. Then the county would place the individual with a provider, and the provider would in turn bill the Behavioral Health Fund for reimbursement. That was the old model. Under this construct, the Behavioral Health Fund was funded mostly by the state, partially by counties, and partially through Medicaid. A number of years ago, the state made the decision to move to what is known as direct access, meaning that individuals can go directly to a provider of choice to receive an assessment and access care. This makes a lot of sense. It really aligns substance use disorder with healthcare services, and that makes sense. But even under this construct, counties still pay the 22.95% portion of that behavioral health fund for individuals that don't have other payer sources. Since that direct access implementation a couple of years ago, counties have considered proposals to eliminate that 22.95% cost share that we pay, since counties no longer have a role in the assessment, in the placement, or in the services for individuals that receive substance use disorder services. This, what once was a model based around function and role, is simply a cost share with no ability to influence services. And that is a theme that you will hear by all of us this morning from the county perspective. So to see in the proposal in the governor's budget would increase the county cost share to 50% for the Behavioral Health Fund is somewhat surprising, considering the limited county role and no ability to influence those services. Statewide, the shift will ultimately be an additional $9 million per biennium placed onto counties. The next area is the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. County Human Services has a limited role in the service delivery of individuals at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. This program is for individuals who are committed and need additional treatment, often after serving a prison sentence. It's important to note that only the court has the authority to commit or discharge someone from MSOP. County Human Services involvement is varied in different ways, but primarily we're involved financially in that we pay for a portion of the cost of care dependent on the person's admission date. The governor's budget proposal would increase the county cost share for MSOP from 10% for those that have been there longer, or 25% those that have been there after a certain date, to everyone having a cost share to the counties of 40%. That would total $39.6 million per biennium to counties. This results in $19.8 million cost shift to counties. And locally, so just for Blue Earth County, we would need to increase this budget line item in our individual county's budget by 120%, or around an additional $300,000. And depending on the county's size, this is proportional across all counties. The numbers are going to be bigger in larger counties and smaller in smaller counties, but the proportional shift is still significant. The next area is competency attainment services. And the role in competency attainment is limited at best for counties. It's important to think about the people that need this level of service. These are individuals who have been accused of a crime. They're not able to proceed with the legal process due to their inability to participate in the legal process. But I will say, they are in great need of inpatient care. They are ill and are often untreated, suffering in jail. So the importance of this is we do want people to receive the services. It's the payment portion of this and some of the technical aspects that makes this problematic. So there are many nuances to this proposal that are worthy of further examination, and we would encourage that, as this relates to changes that were made in the recent years regarding competency attainment under Rule 20 that are now being ordered under Chapter 611. And the person is receiving hospital cares at the DCT facility. This proposal clarifies the financial responsibility for cost of care. And in this proposal, counties would be required to pay for the cost of care for this provision. However, no civil commitment is ordered under Chapter 611. So there likely would be no open social services case and therefore no county of financial responsibility. So we have a bit of a cyclical problem here. Counties are very supportive of people getting the treatment services that they needed, especially when they meet the hospital level of care. The governor's budget would apply existing county cost shares to the competency attainment program as well, for a total of $16.7 million per biennium. The goal of the proposal was to offer clarifying language and find a way to pay for competency attainment in certain circumstances. However, county human service agencies are not likely to be involved in these cases as a person is not civilly committed. We expect that this will create more confusion rather than provide the clarity that's intended. As you can see from these areas that I've spoken about, the county role has evolved in the delivery of human services, and it's unfortunate that in program areas where counties have less and less ability to control the costs, that those happen to be the areas that are currently being contemplated to shift more costs to counties. There has historically been a policy reason for these cost shifts, which arguably have not had the intended impact of being an incentive to counties, as counties simply do not have the ability to influence the outcome. A move further in the direction of shifting costs to counties in service areas where they're unable to control the costs seems like a very unfair position. We recognize that the budget decisions are very, very difficult, and we are here to be partners in the work of having difficult conversations about service delivery, about needed reforms, and about cuts to services. We hope to join you again to talk about our association's priorities, which focus on cost-effective technology solutions, administrative simplification positions, and the necessity of long-term investments in our state hospital system to address the hundreds of people waiting, suffering today to receive intensive hospital level of care services. We appreciate you having us today to start the conversation. And with that, I'm happy to answer questions, but I will turn it over to my colleague who will share with you a bit about waiver services first.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony. We'll take questions as her presentation wraps up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Katie Molinaire. I currently serve as a deputy director within the Social Services Department at Ramsey County. I lead the Aging and Disability Services and MnChoices Division. I'm also here testifying on behalf of MAXA. Thank you again for inviting us this morning. I'd like to add to what Director Youngerberg shared regarding the state and county partnership, and I'll speak directly to the impacts of the governor's proposed budget related to disability waivers. As the name suggests, we serve individuals of any age with a disability. Our disability waiver programs are incredibly complex, from their funding to the complex needs of the residents that we serve. In most instances, the counties work with the state, as my colleague described. The counties serve as the agency that assesses an individual's need for services, determines eligibility based on criteria set forward in state policy, and then works with the individual and or their guardian to set up those services to meet the assessed needs. This may include living in a provider-controlled setting, such as a community residential service. Many years ago, that was referred to as a group home, just to give you a sense of that level of care. There are four proposals within the governor's budget related to reducing the growth of disability waiver services. Within those proposals, there is a new 5% county share for disability waiver services. This totals $82 million in 2027, $97 million in 2028, and $107 million in 2029. In Ramsey County, this 5% cost shift is projected to be $13 million annually, which is equivalent to a 4% tax levy increase. I'll say that again. $13 million annually, which is equivalent to a 4% tax levy increase. It's important to note here that this is our best projection based on the information that we have right now, and we do continue to review and refine that estimate. This is a shift to counties and doesn't save money within the program area. It's also really important to note here that Ramsey County is unique. One in three of our residents is on a safety net program. We are also a county in which our residents' median income is less than the cost of living. The proposed cost shift to counties would have a devastating impact to our residents. We also have serious concerns regarding how this may impact access to services. If counties are not able to sufficiently levy these funds, it may result in vulnerable residents not receiving services that they are assessed to need, or create a patchwork of access across our state's 87 counties. This is not the system that we strive for. The system that we strive for is a system in which Minnesotans are all served with dignity, no matter the county that they reside in. We know that this is the beginning of a conversation regarding how to address the state's difficult budget realities while continuing to serve our state's most vulnerable individuals. Counties do intend to come to the table with ideas. For the last several sessions, we have proposed several measures to simplify and streamline our human services systems in ways that preserve quality services while also reducing paperwork, administrative burden, and lowering overall system costs. We know that technology could be a big part of this solution, and that does require an honest conversation about the one-time costs that would be needed to incur, that would be needed to be incurred in order to drive long-term savings. We don't have any magical solutions for you this morning. Please do consider us as partners as we engage in this ongoing conversation to tackle these challenges. Thank you for your time, and I'm also happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Molinaire.
Thank you, Ms. Molinaire, for your testimony this morning. Any questions for these testifiers at the moment? And they'll be sticking around if nothing comes. Yeah, Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. So I just kind of want to ask a systems question, if that's okay, because I know in other systems we're talking a lot about SSIS, and I honestly don't know when you say, like, paperwork and redundancy and, like, some of that comes down to the system that you use. Can you just tell us what system you use and if the technology system can lean into any of your efficiencies in that space?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. We do use SSIS. We also use Maxis and MMIS. And in our area, we also used, it's called Revised Min Choices. It's an online application where the assessment is completed, and so the assessor will work through those questions, and then it populates the eligibility. That is a newer program, and we are finding some efficiencies, and it doesn't create the amount of efficiency that we need in order to meet current community need. So there's a lot of work there still to do, and Min Choices does not eliminate the need for the SSIS, so we still have staff documenting in that system, which you may know already is old, and we often, it can be very slow or crashes, and then that delays the ability of the staff to enter that timely and move forward to the next resident's case.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I think I just want all of us to note that, because SSIS is showing up in a lot of the different tables that I think all of us sit at, and so kind of connecting the dots sometimes is that to streamline efficiency, I think we hear it over and over and over how old SSIS is and how much, like, sometimes doing that investment might actually help us in the long run. So just wanted to share that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think since we started the conversation on systems, the main, system that drives everything is Maxis. And if we invest in terms of addressing that, it's a 40-year-old system. It's a green screen, and you have to put commands to in order to get to the next step. So we've got Maxis, Prism, MMIS, SSIS, MEC Square is a little bit better, but it's getting old. So I think having a really conversation on this topic is warranted in this committee, so we can see how those systems really function and address the need globally. But otherwise, I think we will be lost talking just about SSIS and not talking about the other core systems that really need that investment. I think this is the time. If we can improve the quality of services, we should start with the systems, and we should have that conversation. On another note, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to know, when it comes to the waiver programs, what role does the county play in terms of rate exceptions, and how is that factored into the budget?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Lanier.
So the rate exceptions, the min choices determines the need. So then the resident would, if they're eligible for a waiver, that would be opened and they'd be assigned a case manager. That case manager then works with the resident and any support staff that they want to include in that conversation to determine what services are needed. If there's a rate exception that they deem is needed, they will fill out some paperwork and they send it in to our team. And our team reviews that and has some dialogue to determine if that is the rate that's required. And so we will often have communication with the provider to understand the rate that's being put forward and try to land on something that will meet the resident's need based on that information.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think to put into perspective, the lead agency is the county, and the county has got the role of assessing and making sure that we are putting the additional resources needed to care for that individual. And so in sense, I think the county is already involved in terms of making the decision on the type of care that the individual needs, so it increases whether the cost will go up or down in terms of how much the county share will be. And to the other question is, we have got the court in, court out when it comes to MSOP or any other civil commitment. It's driven by what the individuals who are coming through the system. And so there's a little bit of a county perspective when it comes to an individual being placed in forensics or MSOP or any other services through the DCT. How does that interaction really work with the county?
Ms. Youngerberger.
Mr. Chair and Representative Knorr, the interaction with the process for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program is a bit different than the interaction, the county's involvement in interaction in other direct care and treatment facilities. So with the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, the courts are the ones that determine, as you said, who is in and who is out. those individuals are often under one or more types of civil commitments, and the county is involved to some degree with those civil commitments, but the long-term plan is really driven through the court system for the MSOP individuals. For forensics and other direct care and treatment facilities, the county's involvement, starts with the civil commitment process. And we may have had that individual open to case management on a voluntary basis in the beginning, oftentimes not. And so it really begins with that civil commitment process. And we have a duty and responsibility to follow and work with the person and create that treatment plan under the guidance of the providers that are recommending what the appropriate levels of care are. And so we're highly involved in those in the care for those individuals at, say, Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center or the Community Behavioral Health Hospitals, and to some degree for individuals at forensics. It looks a little bit different on a case management end because the length of stay in those facilities is vastly different. So someone at a CBHH or ANOCA, their length of stay is measured in days and months typically, where someone whose length of stay at forensics is more in years. And so our involvement varies depending on the acuity of those treatment needs.
Representative Knorr.
One final question, Mr. Chair. What happens when the individual does not meet the medical needs and is supposed to be discharged to the county?
So.
Youngerberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Knorr. What happens when a person is at Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center or at a CBHH or any other direct care and treatment facility in the MSATS realm, So not forensics, not MSOP. When they no longer meet that hospital level of care, so they're admitted, they need that hospital level of care, they are treated, and they're to the point where they need to be discharged from that from the hospital, our county case managers have been working with that individual and with the team since day one. But at that point where they no longer meet level of care, and that has been determined by the physician and the utilization review process in those facilities, the county is then responsible financially for 100% of the cost of cares. And so that is a very large number. And when some of the individuals, for some of the individuals, we have community placement options, or we're able to wrap services around them in their home, and we can discharge them within a matter of days or weeks. In other instances, we really rely on waiver services that are specialized and highly tailored to the individual's needs to get them back out into the community rather than sit in the hospital. So there's costs shifted to the county at that point when they no longer meet medical criteria.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I have one question, too, that I think relates to some of this overall, especially with the systems piece of it. But in determining eligibility, we hear from providers that that can take months to get, especially like in the long-term care spaces in particular, that it's taking a considerable amount of time, and just that, of course, leads to cash flow issues and everything else. Is it just the computer system? Is it a complicated eligibility system? What would be driving some of that piece to the extended amount of time it takes to determine eligibility?
Mr.
Ms. Molinaire.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. It's a great question. In Ramsey County, and I think this is also true across the state, need for services within the home and community-based service system has grown quite exponentially coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic. In Ramsey County, from 2017 to 2023, we saw a 40% increase in residents seeking a Min Choices assessment. That's the assessment that determines eligibility for services. And that has really strained our staffing capacity. And so we do experience, residents are experiencing wait times, which we're working really hard to address. And that's also a systemic challenge in the sense that other counties are also struggling because the need from community is so high. So that's a piece of it, that residents are needing to wait before they get the Min Choices assessment. There are also some other components. So a resident, for most of the waivers, must have medical assistance. And so some residents come to us and they are already on MA, and other times they need to work through that process as well. And I know that service system also has seen an increase in community need. And so there are some, it takes time to get onto MA. A resident also needs a determination of a disability. So that may have already happened through the Social Security Administration, or they may need to be determined disabled by our state medical review team. And that team is within the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And my understanding from what I've heard in other spaces is that they also are seeing an increase in need, and so there are times when that process takes a while for residents to go through as well. So if you're eligible for a waiver, you can't have it opened and start receiving those services until you have your MA in place and also have the disability determination and have worked through the Min Choices assessment process to get your services turned on.
Okay, I'm going to have to go back and listen to that a couple of times. Thank you. Ms. Youngerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to add to what my colleague had said. Some of the main categories that impact this from our perspective are the length of the Min Choices assessment itself, the requirement to reassess an individual when things change, which makes sense, but also to do so annually, even when things aren't changing for that individual, so we're duplicating or redoing work. Staff turnover and amount of training needed for individuals to be able to provide the assessment and do that evaluation. And then also counties are responsible to fund a portion of that assessor role. There is a portion of local levy dollars that go to those assessors, and so we are limited by the amount that we are able to contribute, even though there is state and federal funding coming for those positions. They're not fully covered when you consider all of the administration and overhead and all of the costs that it takes to fund an employee. So we do have natural and local constraints to those resources as well. So we do have to live within our means.
Very good, thank you. Representative Hicks.
I just want to add something to the certification of disability in the Social Security process. So the Social Security process during the first Trump administration, there were changes made around how often people need to be recertified. That was not rolled back by the Biden administration and continues to be in place today. Currently, and with more cuts coming to federal infrastructure of employees, we are seeing longer and longer wait times for Social Security approvals. At this point, most people are waiting 18 to 24 months for first approval. So to give people a sense of what that looks like, it means that if you get hit by a bus today and become injured, it is probably 18 months before you get your first, before you get approved, if you get approved. 75% of cases are denied on the first time. So what that means is you can't access waiver services without being certified disabled. If you cannot get through the federal process for certification, your only option is to go through the state process. So when our testifiers talk about seeing an increase, we have to be able to link that back to the federal slowdown that we're seeing on the federal level that has been happening for 8 years.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's a good question when it comes to the assessments. The 365 days requirement is from the federal government. And I think we need to look into ways when there's an emergency that we can process things quickly. And so I think we've got more tasks to address when there is an emergency or somebody's in the hospital, they need to be discharged and to be able to get the service they need in home and community-based or in any other setting. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Knorr. And thank you for your testimony this morning. We'll move to our next testifiers with the county administrators. If you could please make your way forward. And as you're getting settled in, if you could please introduce yourselves for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning. Chair Schumacher and members of the committee, my name is David Minke and I'm the County Administrator for Pine County. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony this morning. I have the privilege of working with some dedicated county commissioners, and whenever we are working to solve a complicated problem that does not have a clear answer, one of them will invariably say, "I don't know what the solution is, but I know if we work together, we can figure it out." And that is the spirit I bring today. That counties working with legislators can figure this out. Pine is located midway between the Twin Cities and Duluth along Interstate 35. Most people know us for places like Toby's Restaurant and Grand Casino Hinckley or Banning and St. Croix State Parks. We have a population of about 31,000 people, a land area about the size of Rhode Island, and nearly 800 miles of county highways. We're ranked number 86 of 87 counties for broadband, and we're ranked number 80th for per capita income. As you can already tell from that thumbnail sketch, Pine County is a relatively rural county, poor county, transportation is a barrier, and service delivery is challenging. Our total budget is about $52 million. Dividing that into some big chunks, that's about a quarter of it is health and human services, about a quarter of it is public safety, about a quarter of it is roads and bridges, and about a quarter of it is everything else. So human services, roads and bridges, public safety, that really is the bulk of what counties do. The total property tax levy is nearly $22.8 million, or about 43% of our total budget. And this levy requires a tax capacity rate of about 42%, which puts us on the higher end of counties. We estimate that the increase to Pine County of these cost shifts would be about $600,000. To put that into perspective, The cost shift alone would become the sixth largest single expense for Pine County. It would put it below vehicles and equipment, which is $875,000, and above medical services for prisoners at $470,000. So it's a big chunk of money to Pine County. The entire Health and Human Services budget is just over $13 million, and 70% of that is non-levy funds. To fund a $600,000 cost shift would require an increase in the HHS levy of about 15%. This is just one of the many budget challenges for us, and I'm hoping that the state does not just shift costs and it thinks about solving a problem, taking a comprehensive approach that includes system modernization and reform. I want to thank Representative Keeler for bringing up SSIS. Pine County has hosted several demonstrations for legislators and DHS leadership on SSIS and the challenges of using that system. It has a terrible impact on our staff and on our clients. And as an administrator, it's one of those things that I feel powerless to impact because it really is a statewide system that needs support from the state. Once again, I appreciate the committee taking the time today to hear about the impacts to counties, residents, clients, and taxpayers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Minkey. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bruce Messelt, and I serve as the county administrator in Sherburne County. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties, as well as the Minnesota Inter-County Association, also to discuss briefly the impacts that we see in the proposed governor's budget. As Mr. Minkey said, the use of the green screen is still alive and well in Health and Human Services. So if you'd like an opportunity to see it, we'd also invite you to consider coming up to Sherburne County. Sherburne County has 102,000 population. We are north of Interstate 94 and the Mississippi River, and commonly you would see us between Elk River and the eastern portion of St. Cloud. So very wonderful area, not too far from here, and we'd really invite you to come up for a tour of Health and Human Services. You could even have a committee hearing. We'd love to host you. We are a growing county. We are a mix of suburban, exurban, small cities and towns. Also have the newest city in Minnesota, the city of Baldwin, which just voted to become a city in November. We are a mix of rural, agriculture, and some small business manufacturing. We host great communities, amazing schools, wonderful amenities, and of course, really good partners in local government. As you've heard, Minnesota's model is really one of a state-directed and county-administered model for Health and Human Services, and so we think it's appropriate to share with you the impacts in the proposed budget. You've heard some of the categories, so I'll just summarize for you our concerns with respect to the funding of these activities. Based on our 2024 budget, here's what it looks like for Sherburne County. The 5% shift in waiver services is the equivalent of about $1.15 million in additional cost locally. The shift in the MSOP program at 40% would be another $640,000. The SUD services and behavioral health fund at a 50%, there's a net cost increase and there is a net revenue decrease. That's an additional $66,000. We have no way at this point to look at the cost for competency restoration because we only had one at the time, so that's going to be a wild card. And then if we add in the loss of the cannabis revenue, that's another $120,000. So put together, just the shift alone that we can identify in the governor's budget would be just shy of $3 million. That for us is an automatic 5% increase in our levy right then and there. So the impact is appreciable, it's noticeable, and it is significant. I also want to note, however, that that's not taken in a vacuum because there are other activities that the state is undertaking that have interrelationships with your county partners. For instance, we are subject to the community corrections formula, and we are looking next year at a $750,000 hit in community corrections support, dependent upon state funding again. The shift in the Paid Family Medical Leave Act, while it's a very valued program, is another $250,000 on our levy hit. The changes recently in child protection, and again, while we support the goals and the objectives of that very important program, we have concerns about the payment and the costs for those, because those are shifted exclusively on the counties, because child protection is not subject to a lot of state support. For us, that's another $1.75 million. And finally, in the last few years, we've seen both a shift and an increase in court-appointed attorney requirements. For instance, I'll tell you that $80 an hour was the going rate 5 years ago. We had to sign contracts at $150 an hour for all court-appointed attorneys. I don't know about you, but I didn't get a double in my salary. So, you know, if you guys want to take that on, I'll be supportive. But that's an additional $200,000 hit on the county. So all told, we are looking at next year a $6 million increase in shifts from the state to the local government. That's a 10% increase in our levy. And that's before we talk about the local things that we do have control over, such as our salaries and our wages. What we don't have control over is the increase that we're facing in health insurance, the increase we're seeing in inflation, and the loss of our tax base because of shifts like, for instance, with the closure of Xcel Energy Sherco plant. All told, I'll be sitting with the Board of Commissioners next week and talking about a proposed or possible levy increase in the teens. This is unsustainable when you think about the impact on property taxes, the most regressive tax system that is allowed because it has no correlation on income. And that is what happens when the costs get shifted, and that is what we are facing. So stand alone on that, I want to end with just a comparison with county program aid, because a lot of times we hear, well, that's why we give you county program aid. We appreciate it. It's valuable. Sherburne County's county program aid in 2024 was $6.5 million. That's less than 5% of our total budget, and it will be wiped away by these cost shifts next year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Messelt, for your testimony. We also have one more for this presentation that will be joining us through Zoom. Mr. Berry.
Thank you. Good morning. Can everyone hear me okay then?
Very well, yes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, my name is Tom Berry, and I'm the County Administrator for Beltrami County. Thank you for the opportunity to provide information to the committee regarding the realities that rural communities will certainly face as a result of the many cost shifts that have been proposed in the governor's budget. Our story is much like the two presenters you heard before, my colleagues from Pine and Sherburne County. Beltrami County is a rural northern Minnesota county that's home to 46,000 residents, but we serve as a regional hub that provides services to nearly 100,000 people. We are the third largest county and geographic area at over 3,000 square miles, but only one third of our county land is taxable. About 20% of all of our residents live in poverty, and with such a small tax base and a large service area, we boast one of the highest tax rates in the state on a per capita basis. We have very limited means and extraordinary responsibilities. We were quite surprised by, and we strongly oppose, the many cost shifts that were presented in the governor's proposed budget. Specifically, the proposal to shift 5% of disability waiver costs to counties will cost Beltrami County, on average, $1.5 million annually. The total disability waiver costs for 2024 for our county were $46.2 million, and they served just 248 people. This cost continues to escalate year over year because of the state's mandate that there be no waiting list for these services. Beyond the waiver program shifts, the governor's budget also proposes, among other impacts to Beltrami County, an increased cost share for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, which will cost Beltrami County approximately $150,000 or so on average. It also proposes shifting state costs to meet competency restoration requirements, which will cost Beltrami County nearly $100,000 annually on average. It also proposes changes in the Behavioral Health Fund cost share, increasing, as you heard, from 22.9% to 50%, which will cost our county an additional $50,000 annually on average. It also proposes a reduction in the recuperative Behavioral Health Fund administrative dollars, which will cost our county about $30,000 $1,000 additionally annually on average. All totaled, the cost shifts, funding formula changes, and the program reductions proposed in the governor's budget will result in a shifting of state-mandated service costs to our local county Health and Human Services Department that approaches $2 million annually. For Beltrami County, that cost would require a 7% increase in our property tax levy to absorb. This is on top of the new cost of many recent mandates that the state has also imposed on the counties. In the past several years, dozens of unfunded and underfunded mandates for counties were developed by the state, each one with their own unique requirements and cost implications. In one such example, the 2024 African American Family Preservation and Child Welfare Disproportionality Act, recently signed into law with no funding to administer it, will raise Beltrami County's costs by an additional $1.3 million annually. So as you can see, the accumulation of the governor's Health and Human Services budget proposal and just one piece of new legislation would impact our rural county by no less than $3.5 million annually. And that figure does not include inflationary or insurance-related increases, other budgetary items for the county, or the next wave of mandates. To accommodate that impact, I would have to ask my county board for nearly a 12% property tax increase in our next budget. Now, this would follow a combined property tax increase of 21.4% that we have already had to implement over the past 3 years alone to accommodate, in part, similar cost shifts and state mandates. We fully understand the state's desire to reduce its costs and shrink its budget, but shifting those costs onto our local property tax base would be exceptionally harmful, as local governments have even less capacity and resources to absorb them. Rather, examination of the mandates that drive these costs may be more fruitful and profound. To that end, Beltrami County stands ready and would welcome the opportunity to work with the legislature these difficult challenges, find solutions that work for the state, our local governments, and the people we serve. Thank you so very much for the opportunity for me to share our concerns with you.
Thank you, Mr. Berry, for your testimony. Are there any questions for these testifiers? Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair. So, coming from a position of county commissioner for 10 years there, the rural property taxes, especially from the farm community, you've got these acres and acres of land that just don't demand any services whatsoever. And to see this ongoing pressure put on these acres of land, it's just unsustainable for the farming community. But I guess I'd ask the question, what have you seen for a spread between county program aid and the demands put from the state onto that county program aid? How have you seen that grow in, say, the last 10 years?
Mr. Missel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Jacob. The shift in county program aid, first of all, we have to welcome the fact that for the first time in many, many years, there was an increase in county program aid recently, and we really, really appreciate that. But if you look at the percentage of budget that county program aid covered, it's gone down significantly, and I mean probably exponentially over the last 20 years or so. One of the issues is, of course, it's not indexed for inflation, and we understand and respect that decision of the legislature, but that means that it's eroded every year. As you know, one of the cornerstones of the original Minnesota Miracle, which was put together by progressive Republicans working with Democrats across the aisle, was the idea that every community should have a basic level of services, police, fire, in our case, highways, roads, human services. That was the whole purpose of county program aid. When it's down to 5% of your budget, it's significant, but it's not necessarily a driver. It continues to see the spread between needs and receipt very, very substantially. I will tell you that Mr. Hilgard from AMC will provide some additional information on your particular question, but I do appreciate it. In our case, you know, again, we just basically will have to wipe it out just to cover these shifts.
Mr. Hilgard jumping out of his seat to get up there.
Yeah.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and
thank you.
Your testimony.
My name is Matt Hilgard. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. And yeah, thank you very much. It's my first time in 10 years in front of this committee. So eagerly anticipating this opportunity. But I think it was a great question, Commissioner Jacob, because it goes to the point of this unfunded mandate task. When it's convenient, we're an arm of the state. When it's convenient for another side, we're a local government. But in reality, you've heard today of just the lack of control that we have. CPA, and we want to thank you, this legislature has acted in a bipartisan fashion to support investments in county program aid. But I also want to give some historical context for what we're seeing here. CPA is a total represents roughly around 3 to 5% of an average county's budget total. That has really greatly diminished over time. So we've seen an increasing reliance by county governments on property tax systems to fund. For example, some cities will see local government aid cover anywhere from 15 to 35% of their budget. So the city of Pipestone is receiving approximately, I believe, over $1.5 million of LGA. Great, they should. That's a great system for them. The county of Pipestone is receiving roughly $800,000. That's a huge disparity, huge disparity. The other thing that has not been taken into account is where we've been, the trough of the last decade and a half. For example, Lacqua-Parle County in 2002 was receiving $1.2 million in county program aid. From the years of roughly 2014 to 2019, they were down to $120,000 in aid. Folks on this committee, including Representative Backer, created bills alongside other folks on the other side of the aisle to try to right that wrong. But even today, they're only back up to $790,000. That's $400,000 less than they were getting from the state over two decades ago, not even accounting for inflation. So I think if there's any takeaway that you're hearing from counties, it's certainly that this system, this idea that counties are administering, and we are unique in the nation, that we're administering on behalf of the state all these social safety net programs. We're one of a handful of states around the nation that do this. We believe that's good, but at a certain point, it seems like the back is breaking, and that's what you're hearing. You're hearing communities saying right off the bat, before COLAs, collective bargaining, paid family leave, et cetera, inflation, health insurance costs, which can range from 20% increase on any given year that we can't control, we're facing 5 to 10% levy increases just on this proposal. So we're hopeful that this takeaway, we know it's not tax committee, as you can tell, that's the committee that I often reside in, but it is really impactful across the state, and we really appreciate your attention to this. I know there's other testifiers today, but we wanted to convey that message. Thank you.
Representative Jacob.
Yeah, I think that brings out the point I wanted to make. Biggest frustration I ever had as county commissioner, unfunded mandates and the disconnect between the mandates and the rural acres that don't demand any services. So.
Thank you, Representative Knorr.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. As one of the few states, one in 10 county, administered state supervised program when it comes to the human services, I understand the challenges the counties are facing. I used to work for the county. And the challenge right now is, what do we do with constituents, residents of the county who are seeking services if there's no way of cost sharing with the counties? I know it's a complicated question, but the key question is, do we cut costs and reduce the number of people who are getting services, who are disabled or senior, especially in the area of waiver programs, or how do we partner with the state to make sure that those residents really get the services that they need?
Mr. Hilgard.
Mr. Chair, Chair Knorr, I appreciate that question. And that's, I think, what you've heard in all these testifiers, too. These are really serious questions. To be honest with you, we've spent the last 2.5 weeks just assessing the governor's budget and doing most of our work in terms of analyzing the total impact. The numbers that you heard today, that's been our kind of focus. And in each testimony, we've said, we know these decisions are not easy. And they may be decisions of property tax burden versus reductions in service or changes. I really appreciate, and I heard this in a committee just yesterday, Representative Keeler mentioned it earlier, the modernization issues that are facing the state are really, it should be prioritized. One of the displays that we saw just recently in Pine County was watching their child protection workers, their social service caseworkers do intake for a morning on new child protection cases. If no one's had an opportunity to do that, it is eye-opening. It's extremely emotional going through these cases. And these workers are facing this SIS system where they're having to input data 2, 3, 4 times over, then seeing the wheel of death delete it all. We also heard about them going home on the weekend and inputting this on the weekend when they're taking care of their own families because they want to spend the time with their kids. Not only is this a human toll, a caseworker toll, a toll on the folks, individuals, and families that we're trying to serve. It's also a workforce issue and a property tax issue because we're having to pay more people to do these jobs just to fill out the green screen technology, the wheel of death, et cetera. And so we know that this committee has, in years past, dedicated money, modernization funds to the state. We have supported those ventures because we rely on the state. But I think we would be asking this year for a prioritization of making sure that the systems that we keep coming back and saying this is broken, these are the systems that are serving individuals and family, we need them fixed. I think that would help too.
Representative Doerr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, seeing no other questions for these testifiers, the committee thanks you for your time today and making the trip in. Next, we'll move into the public testimony portion, number 4 on the agenda here. We have about 45 to 50 minutes left in committee and about 10 people who are on the list. So we're looking at about 4 minutes testifier to get through that list here. And we'll begin with the policy manager for ARM. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Schumacher and members of the committee. My name is Johnny Tevetz, and I'm the policy manager for ARM, a trade association representing disability waiver residential service providers across Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony this morning relating to the governor's budget recommendations. I'm here on behalf of our members to express our deep concerns and disappointments regarding the proposed cuts to disability waiver services and the impact these proposals will have on people with disabilities and their staff. First, ARM strongly opposes the proposal to cap inflationary adjustments at 2%. This proposal will exacerbate an already dire workforce crisis. Direct support professionals, which are a majority women and people of color, are already underpaid, making an average wage of a little over $17 per hour. This adjustment will further erode their wages. We hear time and time again from these folks that they love what they do, but they can't afford to do it. These caps threaten not just the jobs, but the essential life-saving care they provide to Minnesotans with disabilities. Additionally, ARM has strong concerns with other proposed reductions to the disability waiver rate services outlined in the budget proposal, including limiting rate exceptions, a tool that providers utilize when supporting individuals with exceptional needs, capping billable days to 351 in a calendar year, and limiting individualized home supports with training to 8 hours a day. These proposals, along with other proposals included in the budget, will cut about $1.3 billion over 4 years from disability waiver services, destabilizing and dismantling an already fragile service system. The administration suggests these cuts will not reduce access to services. This assertion is unrealistic. You cannot remove $1.3 billion over 4 years from an already strained system without serious consequences. Low pay and rising costs will lead to greater turnover, uncompetitive jobs, diminished quality of care, and increased barriers for families already struggling to support their loved ones. The governor has spoken about protecting the progress Minnesota has made, yet this budget dismantles the very foundation of that progress. Minnesota is proud to be a leader in compassion and fairness. We strive to be the best place to raise a kid, as the governor often notes, but will it be the best place to raise a child with a disability? Maintaining the full inflationary adjustment and protecting disability waiver services from the bevy of other cuts is not an indication of a program on autopilot, but rather the bare minimum to ensure this workforce and the people they serve are not left behind. I urge you to prioritize this community and protect the services that allow Minnesotans with disabilities to live their meaningful lives. And I appreciate your time and welcome any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tevent, for your testimony this morning. Next, we will take the long-term care imperative. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kyle Burnt. I am here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I will focus my comments on nursing home cuts in the governor's budget. My colleague here will complete our testimony with concerns on the home and community services providers. Since 2020, more than 3,100 nursing home beds have been taken out of service statewide. This includes the 29 nursing home closures in Greater Minnesota, impacting access to care in local communities. Our nursing facilities face significant job vacancies for critical caregiving and nursing roles. This workforce challenge is driving the closures and bed layaways. The governor's budget will place a 2% cap on all future rate increases. It will limit health insurance coverage for our employees and ends planned closure rate agreements and single bed incentives. The proposed cut of $218 million over 4 years cuts deeper than the top line would appear. As members may remember, a cut to Medicaid results in a smaller share from the federal government and a reduction in our private pay that we can get due to rate equalization. In total, nursing homes will see a cut of an estimated $700 million. Also in the governor's budget is $15 million to pay for the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board's minimum wage and holiday pay standards. However, we estimate that these standards will cost nursing homes $200 million. The budget simply does not pay for the standards set by the board. As a reminder, since we are early in session, the forecasted increases reflect past payments, not future money. This is because the system has a 15 to 24 month lag in data to update reimbursement rates. The forecast reflects projected growth based on past expenditures. It is not an infusion of money to help give our hardworking workforce a raise. We are just coming out of a pandemic that decimated our workforce, our reserves, and the spirit of many of our caregivers. It was not so long ago that staffing shortages were so severe the governor had to call out the National Guard to staff our facilities. Mandates for a higher wage for employees while taking away funding, it's most simply put, it doesn't add up. The governor's budget results in Minnesota's 340 nursing homes facing a $900 million cut or gap and undermines the value-based reimbursement model, which has increased wages for our employees and helped to stabilize our workforce. This budget proposal uses nursing homes to balance a budget and puts nursing homes at further risk of closures. We ask legislators to ensure there are no cuts to the Minnesota seniors. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, excuse me, my name is Erin Hubert, and I am here on behalf of Long-Term Care Imperative. In addition to the items that my colleague just raised, I would draw your attention to a few other items in the governor's proposed budget. DHS acknowledges that elderly waiver, the primary way that low-income seniors access services like assisted living, home care, or adult day services, does not have any sort of inflation factor. And while he characterizes that as a plus, it does have very real consequences. It means that rates will not go up at all, even if costs go up for a variety of reasons, including compensation or health care benefits for staff, or increasing or accommodating increased acuity needs of residents over time. This is similarly why we are concerned about the 2% cap proposed for CADI and brain injury waivered services. Providers who care for people with disabilities through services like customized living will not be able to retain access and meet their financial obligations under that cut.
And then switching gears very briefly, the MDH budget proposes a 54% increase in fees to assisted living providers. We already have a growing affordability crisis in assisted living, primarily for middle-income Minnesotans, and this will not alleviate that problem. We believe that there is an urgent need and a vision to ensure that we can care for a growing population of older adults, and we do not see that vision in this budget proposal. Cutting services or hiking up fees is the opposite of what is helpful to seniors and their families. As I close, the Long-Term Care Imperative conducted research in December of 2023 to get a sense of Minnesota's values and expectations in senior care. And what we found was that more than 4 in 5 Minnesotans believe that seniors have a right to housing, care, and support. 79% of Minnesotans believe that the state is not prepared for the aging boom. And 88% of rural Minnesotans expect care within 30 to 40 minutes of their home community. The budget proposed by the governor fails to meet those expectations. The aging boom is here now. There are more people turning 65 than children entering elementary school. Baby boomers started turning 80 this year. 33% of rural nursing home beds have disappeared in the last 20 years, and the governor's budget will deepen a rural access crisis. We urge this committee to reject his budget and instead craft one that better meets Minnesota's expectations and values. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Hi, my name is Chelsea Olson with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the trade association for the nonprofit health insurers in Minnesota. That's Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, Health Partners, Medica, Sanford Health Plan, and UCARE. Thank you for the opportunity today to testify with our concerns around several proposals included in the governor's DHS budget. The first concern we want to call to your attention is the proposal to double the HMO surcharge from 0.6% to 1.25%. Every session, we hear concerns about the cost of health insurance. Adding additional taxes to insurance increases the cost paid by enrollees and small businesses. This tax falls on the fully insured commercial market and the Medicare supplement market. Insurers in the fully insured market are already paying multiple other taxes. In addition to the HMO surcharge, plans pay a 1% premium tax to the Healthcare Access Fund, a 3.5% premium assessment to health fund insurers as well. Combined with the provider tax and the MA hospital surcharge, taxes on this market would collectively exceed 9%. These taxes are significantly higher than what plans pay on the self-insured market, which are around 3.36%. The Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence recently released a summary of healthcare taxes in Minnesota, which was submitted to the committee, and pages 6 and 7 of that do a really good job of breaking down some of these numbers. When this proposal was publicly released, we heard comments that plans have plenty of money and that they can easily pay more in taxes. This is likely a reference to large for-profit insurers. However, in the fully insured market, around 94% of the lives covered are through a nonprofit insurer, most of whom are council members and historically operate with 1 to 3% margins. We should all be working to lower premiums and out-of-pocket costs, not increase them through more taxes. Our second concern is the proposals to carve out the pharmacy and EMT benefits from the state's managed care program. As you have heard in committee walkthroughs, Minnesota uses a managed care model to provide health care to a majority of Minnesotans enrolled in medical assistance. Under this model, participating health insurers, known as managed care organizations, or MCOs, are selected by DHS and counties through competitive bidding process and sign a contract with the state to provide access to care using monthly capitated payments. The managed care model provides several significant benefits to the state, but most importantly, it improves health outcomes because of care coordination performed by MCOs. Care coordination means serving the whole person. This means helping enrollees set up needed appointments with a doctor, helping to arrange transportation to and from that appointment, and if the enrollee receives a prescription for medication, the MCO can check in real time if the member was able to receive that prescription and whether or not they're receiving timely refills. If there's an issue along the way with any of these steps, MCO care coordinators are there to help. Prescription drugs and NEMT services are important components of healthcare, and carving out these benefits will remove vital opportunities to coordinate care. Because these services are currently within a single managed care plan, an enrollee has a single point of contact to turn to with concerns or issues. By carving out the pharmacy and NEMT benefits, enrollees would have to contact three different entities depending on the services they have questions about: DHS for pharmacy, another entity for NEMT, and their MCO for all other services. That being said, the most important question that needs to be answered on these carve-outs is, will the lives of more than 1 million Minnesotans enrolled in managed care be improved? We should focus on enrollee care and member experience first and foremost, and we urge the committee to consider this when their bill is presented. Thank you.
Committee, thanks you for your testimony this morning. Next, the Minnesota Organization for Habilitation and Rehabilitation. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lori Schlutenhofer. I am co-president and CEO of Services for Opportunity Partners, a nonprofit organization that provides residential, employment, and day support services to Minnesotans with disabilities. I also serve on the board of directors for MORE, the Minnesota Organization for Habilitation and Rehabilitation, which is a statewide association of over 100 nonprofit organizations providing employment and day support services to Minnesotans with disabilities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on the governor's budget proposal. When the proposal was released, it was extremely disappointing to see the proposed state funding reductions for waiver-funded disability employment and day support services, services that we have been working hand-in-hand with our colleague providers and the Department of Human Services to continue to provide community-based services and see the possibilities for people with disabilities to be included in their communities. There are two proposals specifically that we are very concerned about and have a huge potential impact, negative impact on services. The first, found on the bottom of page 133 of the governor's Department of Human Services section, would reduce the absence and utilization factor for day services for people. Now, just to put it the most simply, the utilization factor accounts for the fact that we need to have staff on duty, we need to have services available, we need to have transportation services available for people who, because of their disability, may not be able to attend every day. Currently, that factor is set in the rate framework as 9.4%. The governor's proposal would roll that back to 3.9%. To put that in real terms, real world terms, our organization, Opportunity Partners, experiences an absence rate of approximately 11%. For people. We do not choose to put attendance requirements in place in order to be able to pay our staff and pay the bills. Instead, we try to make sure that we have all of those services available for people when they need them. What this would equate to for us is about a 5 to 6% cut in the rates we are paid to provide services. That would very roughly for us amount to approximately $500,000 a year. Again, not in increases that won't go into place, but cuts to revenue we've already invested in our staff and our programs. And I would like to, you know, further elaborate. Those services under day and employment are, they support people to develop lifelong learning interests and enrichment, to get people out and included into their communities so that they can be valued members, respected as part of our society. The second proposal, which is found on page 136 of the DHS section, proposes to cap the scheduled adjustments, inflationary adjustments, to the rates. In January of 2026, under current law, there would be an adjustment based on inflationary factors and data coming from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the CPI. The governor proposes to roll that back and cap at 2%. This would, frankly, have a very devastating effect. We have been speaking with members of the legislature for a number of years about how we are playing catch up with the private sector to be able to confront the workforce crisis that we have and pay competitive wages. We know that most of the rates that we receive go into the staff who provide the service, and making and cutting off the ability to compete in this very difficult workforce would have a devastating impact and reduce access for people who are in critical need of these services. We know that we all as a state have a really hard job before us this session in making some choices. We only hope that this committee will reject the governor's proposal and bring us back to the drawing board to work together to find a solution that gets us to a viable state budget, but not at the expense of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in this state. Thank you. I'd entertain any questions.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lutenhofer, for your testimony today. And next we have NAMI. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness, a grassroots statewide organization dedicated to improving the lives of children and adults with mental illnesses and their families. And I'm also here as co-chair of the Mental Health Legislative Network, which is a coalition of over 40 mental health organizations. The Mental Health Legislative Network is very concerned with the lack of investments and the reductions in the DHS budget at a time when Minnesota is experiencing a mental health and SUD crisis. There has been an increase in the mental health and SUD needs of Minnesotans, especially our children. We're extremely disappointed in the lack of investments to address these crises. There is no additional funding for Medicaid rate increases for mental health and SUD providers, and we know that their rates are extremely low, and we have seen programs close. There are no new investments to fund the building blocks of our children's mental health system at a time when we have children languishing in hospitals and in emergency rooms. There is no additional funding to stave off the funding cliffs faced by mental health crisis teams, which is $8 million, or schooling to mental health grants, which is $5 million. There is no funding to correct the low rate attached to room and board for children in residential treatment so that their families do not have to go through the child protection system. They are simply seeking out care for their children. They have done nothing to end up otherwise in the child protection system. And there is no adoption of the recommendations of the Priority Admissions Task Force, which many of us refer to as the 48-hour task force. We had recommended an addition of 50 beds for direct care and treatment to address the people waiting in jail. And without the movement in this direction, we can see huge, in the future, litigation and potential fines. Other states have faced hundreds of millions of dollars in fines because people are languishing in jail. And frankly, there's just no other investments to really address all the issues facing our system. Much of the savings, about $1.3 billion over the next 4 years, is from capping inflation and making changes to the Medicaid waivers. Many people with mental illnesses use CADI Medicaid waivers. And while it was stated that the waiting list would not grow, people cannot find service providers to do the work because the wages are so low. And we're concerned with the additional limitations being proposed for waivered services and its impact on children and adults with mental illnesses. And I will note that the CADI waiver is what helps move children out of the emergency room, out of the hospital. It what helps move people, adults with mental illnesses, out of our state hospitals as well. So just in closing, I just want to say we think it's time for the state to truly invest in our mental health system, and unfortunately, this budget does not. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony this morning. Next, we have the Minnesota Hospital Association. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning. I'm Danny Ackert with the Minnesota Hospital Association. Before I get to the governor's budget, I want to start out by echoing my fellow provider associations and what we just heard from Ms. Aberholden. Patient acuity is rising across the waterfront. That acuity often ends up in the emergency room, so we know that very well. The capacity is redlining across the state, not across the full continuum. And at the end of the day, the patient is suffering, the patient is not in the right place or is not able to access that care. So I urge this committee to listen to providers very closely this session and understand that our capacity is struggling. We need this committee and the legislature's help. I also want to add some perspective to Representative Keeler's question about modernization of IT. The perspective we have is that hospitals are required to comply with a lot of federal and state regulation, rule, compliance, and also data protection, and cybersecurity is a challenge. So our use of technology is very advanced for those reasons. When our services and systems try to discuss or talk about patients with county or Department of Human Services, it's ships passing in the night, and often that results in longer wait times and more stress for both providers, for both ends, because we're trying to serve that patient. We can't necessarily make information meet. So we definitely support any modernization or all modernization. We know that's a very costly price tag, but right now patients and providers are struggling with that, and that's just greatly adding to capacity issues. To the governor's budget, we are strongly opposed to the proposed pharmacy carve-out. Frankly, it's just a cut to safety net providers and safety net hospitals across the state, primarily for the negative interactions with the federal 340B drug pricing program. We do support making improvements to the pharmacy benefit, in particular eliminating or greatly reducing the negative practices that pharmacy benefit managers used by the MCOs deploy that are greatly harming community pharmacies and independent pharmacies, least of which are very below cost dispensing fees. We know that there's improvements that can be made on that while not harming the 340B program and also the safety net providers that rely on that. One of the reasons why 340B is so necessary is because medical assistance reimbursement is chronically below cost, not only for hospitals, but across the continuum. So 340B is one of the reasons, or the reasons for 340B, one of them being are those Medicaid underpayments. Lastly, the negative impacts of this carve-out are not necessary. Other states, like Kentucky and Ohio, have approached the problems of managing pharmacy benefit by using a single PBM administrator that remains in managed care, appropriately reimburses independent and community pharmacies, limits the negative practices of PBMs, maximizes 340B, and then also maximizes ability for patients to receive their prescription drugs in a timely manner. So we urge this committee and the legislature to consider what Ohio and Kentucky have done. Second, and also lastly, on the governor's budget, we support the extension of audio-only telehealth. The COVID-19 pandemic accelerated the use of telehealth and audio-only telehealth in particular by a decade at least, and that has become the standard of care that patients, particularly in rural areas with very little broadband access or no broadband access, audio-only is a very unique and useful tool in mental health services in particular that we have found, and also you can look at the Department of Health's report on that. We urge this committee to ask the Department of Human Services to release their report on audio-only telehealth and telehealth specifically for medical assistance patients. I think that that's part of the conversation why it's just an extension, not a permanent adoption of audio-only telehealth, and we urge the support for that going forward. And with that, I'll stand for any questions. Thank you.
All right. The committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Next, we have the Minnesota Association of Resource for Recovery and Chemical Health. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. My name is Brian Zervis. I'm the executive director of MARCH. We are a statewide trade association for substance disorder programs and professionals. To start with the governor's budget, one of the things our members see as a positive is the extension of audio-only telehealth. So that one is a keeper. In the other end of the spectrum, concerns about the governor's budget is the lack of investments in rates, in mental health and SUD rates. The department had undergone a massive rate study that included work with providers, and the rates that were developed and introduced last January at the legislature, we feel are an accurate representation of the true cost of delivering care. For more than a decade, SUD providers have been waiting for a rate study, waiting for rates to be implemented. Over that time, costs have gone up related to staffing and overhead without the rates being increasing commensurately. Within the rate study, 8 of the 9 SUD rates were identified as needing a rate increase. On the low end, the group rate had the lowest needed increase of just over 2%. On the high end, low-intense residential reimbursement needs a rate increase of 172%. So you'd imagine providers struggle to provide services where you're going to be losing money and needing to scale back. The biggest concern we have is the longer there's a delay in rates being impacted, the more programs are going to close, which results in less access for clients getting needed services. We know that over the last couple of years, there's been a net decrease of SUD programs, 45 programs in the state, net closures, meaning more programs have closed than opened. And within that, the over 40% of those closures are happening in greater Minnesota. We all know that when programs in rural Minnesota close, it creates an added burden for people to try to access services. We're continuing to meet with the department on some of the other recommendations regarding the behavioral health fund changes, changes to treatment, changes to program integrity and oversight. So we're looking forward to those continued conversations with them. We urge legislators, as you're developing your budget, in the governor's proposal, the projected $355 million surplus at the end of the 28-29 biennium leave some wiggle room for decision makers to be able to get the process of getting rates implemented and started. We know that treatment works. We know that recovery is possible. We see this as a good investment in providing adequate reimbursement for programs to be able to serve people throughout the state. Lastly, I want to thank the committee for listening. We ask for your leadership to ensure that these life-saving programs are not just sustained, but strengthened for the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, SEIU Healthcare, Minnesota and Iowa. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Adelman, and my family lives in Lakeville. I'm a home care worker, and I'm testifying on behalf of my union, SEIU Healthcare, Minnesota and Iowa. We represent over 55,000 workers in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. I want to highlight two important elements in the government's budget. Both make very targeted investments in the workers who provide care to the elderly and the disabled. First, the governor's budget provides about $15 million in the out years to fund the minimum wage from the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. The rule provides an industry-wide minimum wage of $19 an hour in 2026 and 2050, $20.50, the year after. There are higher minimum wages for certified nursing assistants, trained medication aides, and licensed practical nurses. The rule is contingent on you funding the increased cost to the nursing home reimbursement system. You can have absolute confidence that the money will go directly to the workers and will help ensure quality care for our seniors. Secondly, the governor's budget invests $68 million this biennium to fund the tentative contract agreement for over 30,000 SEIU home care workers, like me, in 4 home care programs. The programs include PCA Choice, the Community First Services and Supports budget model, the consumer-directed community supports program and the consumer support grant. The settlement includes a 40 cents per hour raise for some workers in the two programs, PCA Choice and the CFSS budget model. It provides $1,200 stipends with one-time money to help cover out-of-pocket medical costs, and it improves the higher pay enhanced rate for clients with the most severe needs. It also lays the foundation of a defined contribution retirement program. And for a more detailed explanation of the contract changes, please see the letter that we submitted to you. This contract is personal for me. Almost a decade ago, my son, Keegan, a husband, a father of three, and an Iraqi war veteran, was in a motor vehicle accident. He sustained life-threatening injuries, including broken bones, internal damage, and a severe traumatic brain injury. Today, he is unable to speak, feed himself, walk, or perform any activities of daily living. After 10 months in hospitals, we were told to find a nursing home for him. Instead, we brought him home to live with us. We couldn't find staff because the wages were so low and everyone recruited had better options. So I gave up a six-figure career to become his caregiver. I don't have any regrets, but becoming a caregiver was a financial setback for our family. This contract gives me some hope for a retirement plan. It doesn't immediately put any money into a retirement plan, but it sets up the infrastructure for something like an employer 401k. I hope in our next contract we can bargain over some kind of contribution. The home care contract is also contingent upon funding from the legislature. These programs have no automatic inflationary increase for us to bargain over. In a tight budget environment, both proposals directly fund wage and benefit increases for the critical frontline workers who provide essential services for seniors and the disabled. Funding for these programs has always received strong bipartisan support, and we hope to work with you and all members to continue that tradition. Thank you.
The committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Next, Healing Homes Living Services. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Excuse me. My name is Shakaya Richmond. I am the Executive Director of Healing Homes Living Services. I'm speaking today on behalf of Residential Providers Association of Minnesota, commonly known as RPAMN. We seek to represent hundreds of small, predominantly BIPOC-owned residential service providers seeking to provide culturally specific services to individuals with disabilities in our communities. I appreciate the opportunity to comment on the governor's budget recommendations. RPA is deeply concerned over the proposed cuts in residential services for people with disabilities. Specifically, we are concerned with the proposed elimination of the customized living for people under the age of 55. Most of our members are currently licensed by the Minnesota Department of Health as assisted living providers and enrolled with the Department of Human Services as customized living providers, servicing hundreds of individuals under the age of 55 on both the CADI and BI disability waivers. Many of the people we serve are BIPOC Minnesotans who have sought out culturally specific service providers like RPA members and the proposal, like RPA members and the proposal in the governor's budget would mean individuals newly seeking the services could no longer access them. This would restrict client choice and limit access to culturally specific services. One of the things most concerning about the proposal is that the Department of Human Services owns the budget, Department of Human Services own budget documents acknowledge the disproportionate impact of these individuals, but they offer no meaningful solution or method of minimizing the impact of BIPOC Minnesotans on BIPOC Minnesotans with disabilities. The materials simply note other service options for those individuals without acknowledging the ongoing problematic issues going on with alternative services such as integrated community supports or Community First Services and Supports. This is just another instance in a long line of proposals that would make it nearly impossible for our clients to continue to receive services from providers in this community. Beyond the specific cuts to the residential services, RPA has serious concerns over the broader cuts proposed to the disability waiver rate system. With the cost of providing care amidst a workforce shortage, cutting rates will only exacerbate the problem. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, we have Minnesota Services and Strategic Growth. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Josh Berg, and I'm the Director of Minnesota Services and Strategic Growth for Accessible Space, Inc., a nonprofit based in St. Paul. Today I'm here to express my overwhelming disappointment in the governor's proposal, proposed budget, and will highlight a few key areas. First, and while I understand the need for cost-saving measures due to the forecasted deficit, I believe many of the governor's proposals are short-sighted, irresponsible, and ultimately will be ineffective. Thankfully, if anyone reads through the hundreds of pages in this proposal, you'll actually find the exact reasons why you should vote against many of them, and they come straight from the governor's administration. A few items I'd like to highlight are the following. We've already heard about the elimination of customized living services for individuals under 55. The proposal to eliminate customized living services for people under 55 without a clear alternative is extremely problematic, dangerous, and lacks thoughtful planning. Furthermore, the fiscal impact and numbers listed on the change page is simply wrong. There will be no cost savings by abruptly eliminating customized living services without these alternative options, and in fact, there will likely be an increase as more individuals lose their services or who cannot access those kinds of services and end up in more costly, less preferred settings like nursing homes, ICFs, assisted livings, and hospitals. The governor's office also acknowledges that there's already instability within this program, with over 90 people needing new housing and services due to age limitations. DHS created these limitations, along with several others, and could address it without eliminating the program. I, along with others, have ideas and ways to address this and invite the department to work with us on these ideas. The other one is the inflationary cap adjustment proposal. One major question that I have, and I'm not sure the Gov's office or anyone has been able to clarify, is does this proposal eliminate the approved increases set for January 1st, 2026? Many organizations, including mine, have budgeted for these increases to support wage and benefit improvements for our direct support staff. Capping these increases at 2% would result in a significant revenue decrease compared to what we budgeted for, which would be devastating to these efforts. Again, the governor's office acknowledges that this cap could impact the ability to attract and retain quality direct care workers, especially with the growing demand for care due to demographic shifts, and would directly impact individuals with disabilities. Finally, we heard a lot from the counties and the shifting costs to local government. I'm an elected official down in Elko Newmarket and sit on a few different boards in Scott County, so I can appreciate this from that perspective. Shifting state costs to find state savings to local governments, particularly counties, is short-sighted, reckless, and irresponsible. This approach could lead to disparities in fiscal capacity, administrative complexities, and negative impacts on service providers. Those are the governor's words in the actual change page. Again, the governor's office clearly articulates why this is a terrible idea by saying that, establishing a county share for residential services may introduce challenges such as potential disparities in counties' fiscal capacity, administrative complexities, and impacts on service providers, unquote. I appreciate the time today to briefly review just a few sections that are most problematic. I also thank you in advance for the work you will do over the next few months to come up with better, more effective, and more innovative ways to bend the cost curve. Together, we can do something. In fact, you'll see me and many others in this room bring forward ideas this session that actually can reduce total cost of care and services across the state while also innovating and enhancing access and quality. These will include things like expanding Minnesota's currently only community care hub, building off the work that we did at the Acute Care Transitions Advisory Council that we shared in our legislative report, as well as other ways to help DHS be more efficient and streamlined. And those real and innovative ideas, Mr. Chair and Representative Knorr, is where we can actually decrease cost, maintain appropriate access, and ensure accountable and quality services to the individuals living in our communities. Thank you again for the time today, and happy to answer any questions you may have and or follow up with any one of you one-on-one to discuss the bills and ideas that you will see in front of you.
Thank you for your testimony today. Is there anyone else who wishes to provide testimony this morning? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thanks for the opportunity to share some testimony this morning. My name is Marcus Schmidt. I'm fortunate to lead Hearth Connection. We're an organization that's uniquely positioned between government, direct service providers, and community stakeholders across the state of Minnesota. Our focus at Hearth Connection is supportive housing, where we connect direct service provider partners with resources to serve people with long histories of homelessness. For us and our 35 partners across the state, housing, that's supportive housing, is both a noun and a verb. You need the affordable, safe place for people to live, and you also need the support to help people find it and keep it with services that help improve people's well-being and their stability. We know there's urgency in our communities, rural, suburban, and metro, to provide long-term solutions for people with long histories of homelessness. Supportive housing is a proven, long-term solution for breaking the cycle of homelessness. It's been tested here in Minnesota and across the country. Simply put, supportive housing works. I'm here today to briefly highlight two critical supportive housing programs: housing support and housing stabilization services. The housing support program has been a critical source of funding for supportive housing programs addressing homelessness for nearly 20 years in Minnesota. However, in July 2020, a state law was implemented to cut this rate by 50% for those eligible for medical assistance housing stabilization services, also referred to as HSS. Providers have found the reduced rate unsustainable due to problems with HSS, forcing them to make difficult choices between enrolling their clients with HSS or maintaining their core service levels. As a result, many providers have stopped offering HSS or serving eligible individuals, which has severely reduced housing opportunities for people exiting homelessness. This session, we're hopeful that the housing support rate will be restored temporarily while improvements are made to the Housing Stabilization Services Program. I'm here today to express our support for the funding that's included in the governor's budget to increase that staff capacity so that we can ensure that Housing Stabilization Services is an effective, supportive housing program. I also look forward to more discussion with members of this committee about the need to temporarily restore the housing support rate to prevent service providers across the state from reducing their programming or closing altogether. Minnesota's supportive housing infrastructure is very fragile, and failing to respond will only lead to more Minnesotans experiencing homelessness. Thanks for the time to allow me to share testimony, and thank you so much for your public service.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the 2 minutes we have left here who wishes to testify? Seeing none, we will get the opportunity again tomorrow at 8:15 to meet. We'll be hearing from the Department of Human Services on the budget proposals. So with that, we'll see you all at 8:15 tomorrow morning. We are adjourned.